This is the Bloomberg Advantage with Corey Johnson and Carol Masser on Bloomberg Radio.
Imagine how the world could be so very fine, so happy together.
Greg Portell joined us right now, partner at A.T. Kearney, with a look at the tech deals that have gone down this year. And, Greg, one of the things that strikes me is we've seen so many different kinds of tech deals today. If you'd asked me at the beginning of the year if we're going to see a lot of private equity buying cloud software companies at high valuations, I wouldn't have thought that was possible. And yet that's been a dominant theme here in the sort of mid part of this year in tech.
Absolutely. I mean, when you think about the deals that get done, they generally tend to get done for three reasons, either the content acquisition piece, the scale piece, or the capability piece. And as cloud and other technologies emerge, that capabilities piece becomes more and more important.
One of the other capabilities is when you have a lot of money, you can go and sue somebody, and you can support a lawsuit. I'm talking about the Gawker lawsuit and Ziff Davis. This is a forced sale, if ever there was one.
It really underscores the fragility of these new media companies, because if you think about the history of a company like National Enquirer that has published outlandish things for years and years and years, but yet despite their legal challenges, they've been able to remain pretty much unscathed. But yet here's a lawsuit from an aggrieved individual who all of a sudden puts one of the budding stars of media out of business.
A dramatic story indeed, but I it seems like a one-off here.
It absolutely does seem like a one-off, and I think from the legal side of it, there's probably not much interest. From the business side of startup media, the relative instability of these companies when you get down to their core infrastructure is noteworthy.
Well, let's talk about the other big deal that I got to say is LinkedIn and Microsoft. Is there a chance in your mind? I mean, when you take a look at the history of these kinds of deals, I mean, 5 years out, does anybody really remember whether the deal worked or not? Or do they just kind of look around and go, well, that we got to buy something else. It's 5 years plus.
There's always good business cases to be written about these deals if we all go back to Time Warner AOL. But the interesting thing about the LinkedIn-Microsoft deal is the valuation that LinkedIn was able to get. Because if you look at these media companies and you think of their assets being the eyeballs they attract, and you think of LinkedIn as both the combination of a media company and a social network, the valuation on those eyeballs was almost 3-to-1 in the LinkedIn deal. So Microsoft was paying 3-to-1 over what you might see in a Verizon Yahoo deal, for example.
Yeah, although in this case, I think that it was looked at more as a software asset or an asset to build software on than anything, than a real media property.
Well, they definitely need to find a way to push, whether it's cloud software or networking software or system software, through that pipeline that LinkedIn gives them. Otherwise, you're right, the deal doesn't make any sense. But when you have 433 million members, it's hard to ignore the media side of that deal.
Just to ask you about those kinds of numbers, 430 million members. We don't really know, do we?
Of course not.
I mean, it's like all these figures that they throw around for advertising, for impressions, and you have no, I mean, you could have five accounts. You got six different emails. I mean, how does anybody really know?
Well, and that's the challenge when you look at these deals, because even if you go to the infrastructure companies that are supposed to be measuring these types of assets, whether you're looking at a ComScore or a Quant or someone else, they will all have different unique visitor numbers. And that makes it very difficult to put any sort of definitive value on these markets.
Well, although in the annual filings of both Facebook and LinkedIn, they talk about the issue of duplicate accounts, and they think that it's less than 3% or even less than they give numbers in each case, but the most it's ever been is 3% of duplicate accounts, that the numbers are real. So, you can
dump
the numbers.
They say, right?
It is what they say, but it's what they attest to in their legal filings. I mean, it would be a significant scam if that were not the case.
No, I'm not saying that they know something different than what they're purporting to sell to investors.
And from an advertiser's point of view, or if you're looking to use those as a channel to engage consumers, the user base, the membership base, is really of less interest. It's how many views and how engaged the audience is at any given time with the property. So you're absolutely right, Corey. It's very inauthentic to think that they would knowingly give you wrong user data. The question's going to come down to how do you actually engage and communicate with a consumer group? Because that's what advertisers are going to pay for. And that's the part of the market that's still evolving, even as fast as we're going today.
What happens to margins? I mean, in this kind of business, I mean, do the margins just get smaller and smaller and smaller? I mean, we've seen the margins get crushed in just about any business that technology inserts itself into. Is that going to be the case?
It'll really come down to what part of the equation you're on. From a content producer, if you generate good content, you should be able to get a premium for it and push up margins. If you're a utility...
Yeah, but we talk about things like sponsored content or what they call native advertising. It's not even, it's not genuine independent editorial. It's paid for by the advertisers themselves. And sometimes you have trouble figuring out, well, is it written or is it produced by the company that's trying to sell you something, or is it produced by something that's independent?
From the publisher side, though, that's highly profitable.
I understand, but at a certain point, the user is going to say, wait a minute, I'm not sure that this review was really accurate because they didn't even include the ones that are competitors.
Well, the question about reviews and paid content is a little bit different because the reviews and the ethics around how do you build reviews and things like that, the FTC is looking at how do you delineate and things like that. So that's a different angle than sponsored content where you're actually using the expertise of a media house to develop insightful content on a point of view that's relevant to an advertiser. So if we think about classic media and the concern over the church-state wall, sponsored content is the way to break down that divide in a way that's profitable for publishers.
If the users buy it, I mean, what we see from the world of clickbait is that people, you know, are wise to this stuff, and the returns and the clickbait ads and so on are going down. When I talk to marketers, they're telling me they're just not getting paid for that stuff like they used to be.
Well, and that brings you back to the fundamental, you know, paramount need for all content is it has to be high quality. You can't get by with just producing pages that don't have value. Just like any branded company, whether you're selling Cheerios or Wrigley gum, the branded content has to be worth more than the generic content. Otherwise, the whole model will fall apart.
Greg Portell, partner at A.T. Kearney. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Hey, I want to get a headline in here. George Soros' giant $25 billion family office is replacing its CIO after less than a year. Ted Burdick will step down as soon as they find a replacement. He just started that job in January of this year. So a big shakeup there at one of the biggest family offices of all time. In George Soros' office. You're listening to Bloomberg Advantage on Bloomberg Radio. Corey Johnson with Pim Fox. This is Bloomberg.
Global business news 24 hours a day at Bloomberg.com, the Radio Plus mobile app, and on your radio. This is a Bloomberg Business Flash.
This Bloomberg Business Flash is brought to you by Sector Spider ETFs. Why buy a single stock when you can invest in the entire sector? Visit sectorspdrs.com or call 1-866-SECTOR-ETF. Well, Wall Street is pulling back from all-time highs on all three main benchmarks. Lackluster data is offering little incentive for investors to push equities higher. A report today showed sales at U.S. retailers were little changed in July as Americans flocked to auto dealers at the expense of other merchants. Another report showed wholesale prices unexpectedly fell in July by the most in almost a year, a sign that inflation is likely to stay muted. We check the markets every 15 minutes throughout the trading day. Dow Industrial Average is down 69 points, 0.4%. At 18,543. S&P 500 down 5 points, 0.25% at 2180. The NASDAQ is down 9 points, 0.8%, trading at 5219. West Texas Intermediate crude oil up 81 cents a barrel, 1.9% to 44.30. Spot gold down $6.90 a ounce at 1343. 10-year treasury up 15/32 with a yield of 1.50%. And we've just learned that Ted Burdick is stepping down as chief investment officer for George Soros's $25 billion family office after less than a year in the role. People familiar with the matter say Burdick will remain in his current post until a replacement is found, and he'll then return to running a credit portfolio at the firm. That's a Bloomberg Business Flash. Over to you, Corey and Pim.
Thank you very much, Catherine Calderi. It's Corey Johnson and Pim Fox here. You are listening to the Bloomberg Advantage.
There's one for you, 19 for me. I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the
We're taking a look at taxes. Hillary Clinton, Democratic nominee for president, and her running mate, Tim Kaine, senator from Virginia, releasing a new batch of their own income tax returns, showing that Mrs. Clinton, along with her husband, former President Bill Clinton, adjusted gross income of $10.6 million for 2015, paying an effective tax rate of just a little bit more than 34%. Here to tell us more is Tolu Olorunipa. He is our Bloomberg News government reporter. He joins us from our bureau in Washington, D.C., home to Bloomberg 99.1 and 105.7 HD2. Tolu, tell us about this release of tax information. Is this meant to highlight the fact that Donald Trump and his running mate, Mike Pence, the Indiana governor, have yet to make their tax information public?
Definitely. That's exactly what Secretary Clinton is hoping to do with this release. She's trying to paint herself as incredibly transparent and open about her finances while opening questions about Donald Trump and his finances, how much he's paid in taxes, whether he's given money to charity, whether he's as wealthy as he claims to be. All of those are questions that they're raising about Donald Trump with this release.
This release, it's really interesting, the Clinton's family's release. For a lot of reasons, but it really does kind of detail what their life was like in this last year. Hillary Rodham Clinton last year, as just her speaking business alone, which is run under an entity called ZFS Holdings, had $10,492,000 in gross receipts.
Yes, the Clintons are at this point very well known for being very lucrative on the speaking trail. They've raised hundreds of thousands of dollars at a time per speech, and that's all laid out in this report, in this tax filing that they did. Hillary Clinton's speaking income actually declined in 2015 because she was out on the trail running for president compared to previous years, but she still managed to rake in hundreds of thousands of dollars for every appearance, the same for Bill Clinton, who has been a very lucrative speaker for many years now.
And as an author, she also took in $5.6 million as an author.
Yeah, she has her book that continued to sell, and she had the advance on that book, the book detailing her years as Secretary of State, Hard Choices. It was a very lucrative book, as we see politicians and cabinet members, once they leave office, they can cash in on their experience by writing about their term in office.
Tolu, combined with today's release of information, the Clintons have also made their tax returns available dating back to 2007. And if you start in 2007 and then come all the way forward to this most latest release, it shows that during that period they had adjusted gross income of $150 million. Is it at all relevant what happened in the past to what is going on now in terms of trying to get Mr. Trump to reveal his tax information? Is it possible that his taxes are so much different than the Trump's? I mean, than the Clintons, I beg your pardon?
That's the question that the Clinton campaign is trying to raise and sort of trying to sow doubt among supporters of Donald Trump about what may be in his taxes. The Clintons sort of have opened themselves up for scrutiny through releasing their tax returns, and there's a lot to be discovered in there about how much money they've made, about how much money they've spent on travel, about how much they're giving to charity. They're saying that Donald Trump has not opened up with the American public about all of these issues and others by not releasing his tax returns. And that's a question I think they're going to continue to hit him on for the rest of the campaign. And Donald Trump has said that he's under audit and is not going to release his returns until that audit ends. So it's something that has been a tradition in presidential politics, and I don't think the Clinton campaign is going to let Donald Trump slide by with that excuse. They're going to continue to hit him on it, and we'll probably see ads here in the fall specifically outlining their complaint about Donald Trump not releasing his tax returns.
Is this a complaint that has resonated? Have there been polling and stuff on this? Or, you know, this is a Friday release in the summer. I mean, they could have picked a time when this would have got more attention.
Yeah, I think they want to sort of continually raise this issue because it does resonate with a specific group of voters who are specifically focused on issues like honesty and integrity. That's something that Hillary Clinton has struggled with. And so I think obviously they're going to time it in a way that they think benefits their campaign. We'll probably see more of this sort of trickling over the next few months. I don't think they wanted to focus all of their efforts on it just yet, because a lot of people have tuned out the campaign or haven't really tuned in yet. But I do think it resonates with a certain group of voters, and we'll probably see the Clinton campaign trying to target those voters in September and October.
All right. Tuluola Ornapah covers politics for us at Bloomberg News. Thank you very much. Well, you've been listening to the Bloomberg Advantage with Corey Johnson and Pim Fox, but the Iron Man continues. Pim, you're going to stay. You're going to sit in there.
Well, we've got taking stock.
You do taking stock.
Due to the close of trading. Yeah.
He's Iron Man.
This is Bloomberg.